intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hi, this is Dick Shanley, and for the next hour, I will be reading from Sunday, October 19th, issue of the New York Times opinion section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. What does it mean to be a good Muslim in America? Written by Maher Ahmad, an editor in the opinion section. A few days before Zohran Mamdani's decisive victory in the Democratic primary for mayor of New York, a friend and I were speculating about his chances of winning. We indulged in a moment of giddy optimism at the prospect that a Muslim man might actually become the mayor of the city we live in. With the polling available then, it seemed plausible. If he does, my friend, Arman Dzizovic said, it's about to get so much worse. Arman was referring to the wave of anti-Muslim vitriol already swelling toward Mr. Mamdani and his campaign, including suggestions that he was a terrorist sympathizer or even a terrorist himself. Arman, a Muslim like me, felt that the higher Mr. Mamdani's star rose, the worse the anti-Muslim racism would get. I did not disagree. Then we both felt silent. The shared understanding of what it means to be a Muslim in America hung in the air between us. It's a confounding time to be Muslim in this country, a degree of Muslim culture I would have never thought possible when I was a kid, is now imbued in the everyday lexicon of Americans. I'm still a little shocked every time I hear non-Muslim teenagers say, Inshallah. My friend and I were having this discussion about Mr. Mamdani while sitting in a trendy Yemeni coffee house, one of many proliferating across the country, as places where young Muslims and non-Muslims alike hang out after hours instead of at bars. And yet, with every inch of progress, we've come to expect bigoted outbursts against people who share our faith and take up places of prominence. More than two decades ago, after September 11, 2001, we've learned to anticipate the patterns of anti-Islamic hate. After a terrorist attack, the bombing of another Muslim-majority country, or simply when a high-profile Muslim enters the public consciousness, we can count on crude anti-Muslim prejudice to bleed into our social media feeds, with the nomadic good versus evil narratives peddled by politicians coming quickly in their wake. So it came at no surprise when, within hours of Mr. Mamdani's primary victory, right-wing politicians and talking heads called him Little Mohammed, accused him of wanting to enforce Sahara, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, Shara, S-H-A-R-I-H, and insinuated that his victory could bring about another September 11th. But more insidious is the pernicious Islamophobia that has morphed into the year since the attacks in Israel on October 7th, 23. The cown had seeped into the liberal institutions that claim to oppose racism and prejudice. The actors' actions have helped lay the groundwork for the Trump administration to take anti-Muslim attitudes and codify them in policies and law, with far-reaching consequences for Muslims in America. In these spaces, Mr. Mamdani is not Little Mohammed, but instead a virulent anti-Semite who portends violence for Jewish New Yorkers, on the account of criticism of Israel and his faith in Islam. After 2 years of war in Gaza and nearly 9 months into President Trump's second term, the treatment of Mr. Mamdani, 34, has served as a black light, revealing the flecks of anti-Muslim bigotry that still dapple American institutions. The candidate has become an avatar for many things, but when it comes to Islamophobia after October 7th, Mr. Mamdani is the poster child for the double standards that Muslims in America are held today. The term Islamophobia can seem like a misnomer. It is really a phobia, the way one can be afraid of spiders or heights, or it's simply a form of prejudice. However you put it, much of the experience of being a Muslim in America amounts to assuaging the fears of others, even if those fears are rooted in bigotry. Many of us learn how to react to that fear early. After the attacks of September 11th, my family, like so many others, put American flags outside our house and one on our car. Once I started getting stopped by airport security at age 11, my parents instructed me to always make eye contact with agents, to speak to them confidently and with a smile. These are the local equivalent of putting your hands in the air, of making it clear you're one of the good Muslims, lest someone think with the ability to make your life worse thinks you're one of the bad ones. I met Mr. Mamdani one afternoon last month in his campaign offices, where he encountered similar experiences growing up Muslim in New York after 9/11, was to some extent growing up having been marked as the other, he told me. I faced what I think many Muslim kids faced, he said, whether it's the names, the characterizations, the motivations. If his experience coming of age after September 11th was anything like mine, Mr. Mamdani and I are almost the same age. There was a shock to be singled out for our faith after the attacks. A degree of Islamophobia exists in America before that day, of course, but after it, a pall of suspicion fell over all of us, one that is never fully lifted. As a child, I found it confusing. Why was I, a fifth grader, getting stopped at the airport? Because I could be a terrorist. The logic didn't track. But then you live with it, and living that reality informs how you see the rest of the world. That's true for Mr. Mamdani, too, in some ways, he said. It was also a preparation for being in politics. The preparation is evident on the campaign trail. Mr. Mamdani answers the relentless questioning of his beliefs about Jews, anti-Semitism, Hamas, October 7th, Israel's rights to exist, on and on. With unwavering chipper attitude, regardless of how he answers them, do you condemn questions deftly associated with him, the actions and phrases that don't always come directly from him, testing, probing, goading him to misstep? It's manning to watch, yet he answers them all, sometimes with a winking sense of humor. At a town hall meeting of mayoral candidates hosted by the UJA Freedom of New York in May, he paused in the midst of a similar line of questioning on Jews and Israel, smiled and said, "These are softballs. Come on." The crowd tittered. I asked Mr. Mamdani whether he's seen his Muslim identity as part of the reason he's repeatedly questioned about his views on Israel. I think it's part of it, he said. I also think of my having stood up for Palestinian rights throughout my political career is another part of it. It's not that hard to imagine how the consciousness of Palestinian suffering was woven into Mr. Mamdani's political identity. Raised by his mom, Mira Nair, an acclaimed Indian filmmaker, and his dad, Mahmoud Mamdani, one of Cologne University's more prominent anti-colonial professors. So Ramandami grew up with intellectuals like Edward Said and Rashid Khali over for dinner. He was a founding member of the Bowdoin College chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, and a regular fixture as protest against Israel incursions into Gaza well before October 7th, 2023. Since the war began in Gaza, he's made speaking up for Palestinians a part of his political agenda. As a state assemblyman, he sponsored a bill to prevent nonprofit corporations for supporting illegal Israeli settlements, led a five-day hunger strike in front of the White House, and was arrested as part of a sit-in organized by Jewish Voice of Peace in front of Senator Chuck Schumer's home. But he's also Muslim, and to be a Muslim now is to grow up with the understanding of the injustices facing Palestinians that is deeper than most people's. For much of the past two decades, the American Muslim understanding of the Palestinian struggle was part and parcel of the knowledge that our lived reality cleaved away from the mainstream narrative of the war on terror. As our communities were surveilled and our home countries bombed and invaded, what many Muslims knew to be true, that the war on terror wrought chaos and the death of hundreds of thousands of Muslims, that had nothing to do with the attacks on September 11th. Remained a belief we could speak only in hushed tones to one another. There was a real sense of contradiction between what was stated and what was actually happening, Mr. Mandami told me. I asked him about his memory of those years. He was 9 years old on September 11th. I learned very young, even in understanding my family's own history, that no matter if you cared about politics, politics cared about you. In New York City, by the police department, in New York City, where thousands of Muslims were followed by the police department in a sprawling surveillance program, later declared unconstitutional, Mr. Mamdani remembers how seemingly basic activities, like a visit to a mosque or a soccer field, would result in finding yourself watched. It was the banal, it was everybody, he said, the inversion of innocence and guilt. Kashif Shalka, the head of Pillars Fund, a nonprofit that helps fund Muslims, Americans, cultural, and political projects, remembers how hard those years were. If you're going to speak out against that war, he said, they would frame it as you support the terrorist. But as the jingoism peaked during the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq began to fade, we were starting to see a little bit of progress, Mr. Shalka said. There was a lot of building that was happening over the last 20 years. Muslim political organizations like the Muslim Civic Coalition and the Muslim Public Affairs Council were created or expanded. And as more Muslims rose through the ranks of American society, the veil of fear across the Muslim community in the aftermath of September 11th began to fade. Our generation has the confidence that we have something to offer to the dialogue of New York, and other than apologizing for what other Muslims did on 9/11. Ali Najmir, Mr. Mandami's election lawyer and a longtime political confidant of his, told me. At 41, Mr. Najam is emblematic of the many Muslims in America who have found their footing in American politics. A child of Pakistani immigrants, he is among dozens of Muslims now helping shape Democratic policy in and out of office, including Representative Rashid Tlaib, Ethan Omar, Andre Carson, and Latifa Simone, and Minnesota's Attorney General Keith Ellison. As mainstream American pop culture embraced more Muslims, Rami Yosef, Riz Ahmed, and Bella Hadid were seen just as terrorists, Mr. Shaki told me, were seen as full human beings. But passing the good and bad litmus test remains a cost of entry for Muslims who aspire to reach the upper echelons of power in American society. Mr. Mamdani is no exception. It wasn't until a week before the Democratic primary that one of the "Do You Condemn" questions finally gave those ready, even eager to find fault with Mamdani, the smoking gun they were looking at, asked by a podcast host when he made a protest chant like "Globalize the Intifada" and "From the River to the Sea." Mr. Mamdani responded by first speaking to the fears and traumas of Jewish New Yorkers after October 7th, but didn't announce other phrase outright. As a Muslim man who grew up post 9/11, I'm all too familiar with the way in which Arabic words can be twisted, can be distorted, can be used to justify any kind of meaning. The backlash was swift, and its repercussions may well follow him even after this race. His critics pounced on the interaction. Multi-Jewish organizations condemned his lack of condemnation of either phrase or other, took the opportunity to denounce him as a material danger to the Jewish community. For example, Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League suggested Mr. Mamdani was supporting an explicit incitement to violence against Jews. Mr. Mamdani secured more votes in the primary than any other New York Democrat in more than three decades. His win was hailed as a harbinger of hope in the Democratic Party, proof positive that a multi-ethnic, multi-class coalition could inject energy into the stagnant politics of a party that otherwise has been floundering in the Trump era. Within hours of his victory, those social media posts telling Jewish New Yorkers that they were in danger began to proliferate online. Some even went as far as to say the Jews need to leave the city for their safety. After the first Muslim candidate ever won a primary for mayor of New York City, one of the first articles this newspaper published quoted a post by the writer Jill Kargman, who said that the election result was like a spiritual Kristallnacht. It proved Jew hatred is now okay. In the months since the primary, Mr. Mamdani has been called anti-Semite repeatedly online and in person. People often shouted at times as he walks through the streets of the city campaigning. The label has stuck despite the fact that he campaigned against Brad Langler, the comptroller, who was the highest-ranking Jewish official in New York City, and despite the fact that polling has shown that a plurality of Jewish New Yorkers plan to vote for him. When an accusation is leveled against you, again and again, no matter how you respond, it sounds as if you are guilty, Mr. Mamdani told me. And to someone watching from afar, it's as if you invited the conversation. Two years after October 7th, the specific accusation made repeatedly against Mr. Mamdani is familiar as one to many Muslims. Hundreds of us, if not thousands, have been sidelined or silenced since under the banner of anti-Semitism. For the first time last year, we saw employment termination climb to the number one spot of request for assistance. Afnaf Nasher, the head of the Council of American Islamic Relations of New York, told me, overnight, CAAR New York has said they've become experts in free speech. An editorial comment. Objectively, if someone objects to the genocide that's being done in Israel, so a Palestinian could object to that, obviously, and to how Mr. Netanyahu is, but they're not objecting to the Jewish people per se. There's a huge difference there. Mr. Nasher said that many of the firings or employment disputes that come across her desk recast advocacy for Palestinians, specifically pro-Palestinian speech. It's inherently anti-Semitic. Hessen Jabbar, a labor and delivery nurse at NYU, was fired for describing the bloodshed in Gaza as a genocide. As an acceptance speech she gave for an award she got for displaying compassion and care to her parents. Another editorial comment. 67,000 people can't be killed, and all those little babies dead, and not accuse the military. Okay. In Maryland, a middle-aged school teacher, Hiba Sayed, was told that a sticker of the Palestinian flag described in her classroom, one of many flags smaller than a knitted scarf, could be seen as anti-Semitic, as was a keffiyeh, the sometimes wore, not to mention a sweatshirt, with the words, Gaza, soul of my soul. She had a spotless record on her school. She kept her job but was told to sign a document saying that she could be fired if she displayed anything to do with the Middle East on the campus. Like Mr. Jab said, had no employment issues before October 7th. Sahar Ari is a law professor at Rutgers, has spent years studying the ways in which civil liberties have been suspended for Muslims in America after September 11th. She said the perception of Muslims as inherently Jew-hating or violent have paved the way for attacks on pro-Palestinian speech. I say Muslims and Palestinians together because you cannot disconnect those two in terms of people's perception in the United States, she told me. The reason anti-Palestinian racism is so salient and so effective and acceptable is because it rides in the back of Islamophobia. Not all attacks on pro-Palestinian speech are Islamophobic, Ms. Azar said, but the two often bleed into each other as American institutions convulse with protest against the Israeli campaign in Gaza. Anti-Muslim language, in instance, the murder of a six-year-old Palestinian-American named Wadi El-Fayoun, the shooting of three Palestinian college students in Ramat, dozens of incidents of mosques vandalized and threatened, were already on the rise. The attempts at suppressing pro-Palestinian speech, using anti-Semitism as a cudgel, were well underway at the time Mr. Trump was elected for the second time. Palestine Legal, an aid organization that supports Palestinian voices, legal action in the U.S., said it received more than 2,000 requests for legal aid in 2024 alone. With groups like Project Esther, an initiative of the Heritage Foundation, same group that devised Project 2025, whose stated mission is to suppress pro-Palestinian speech. Ms. Aziz suggested we are seeing something comparable to the era of the Patriot Act in the early 2000s, where the quashing of civil liberties became government policy. It means the future may be worse, she said. The more institutional it becomes, the harder it is to combat. But the Trump administration has taken the language and institutional policies and codified them. In January, Mr. Trump used the executive order to combat anti-Semitism. The order was given the green light for the Department of Justice to establish a multi-agency anti-Semitism task force, which has, among other things, moved to arrest and deport, or according to the order, otherwise hold to account those deemed guilty of anti-Semitic harassment under a vague definition of what anti-Semitism could entail. Excuse me. The logical extreme of those policies has already arrived in full force. Rumseya Öztürk, a graduate student at Tufts, was part of a group that wrote an opinion essay for the campaign campus paper calling for the school to divest from Israel. As a direct result, she was snatched from the street by mass immigration of customs enforcement agents and ferried into a detention building in the unmarked car. Mahoum Khali and Momo Dudu, who both led pro-Palestinian demonstrations at college, and Mr. Öztürk are among the dozens of Muslims facing the threat of deportation for their protest against Israel's campaign of indiscriminate violence in Gaza. In all three cases, Trump officials and lawyers have contended that their speech was anti-Semitic and that their participation in activities protected under the First Amendment amounted to material support of a terrorist group. "We don't want terrorists in America," Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, said of Mr. Khali and others like him. The accusations of being a terrorist sympathizer, of being an extremist, these are facts of life for many Muslims who engage with any part of public life. Mr. Mamdani told me, "And the notion to stand up for Palestinian rights is to somehow to be a bigot in what so many face, whatever they express, that solidarity." Trump administration officials have called Muslims supporting Palestinian anti-Semitic terrorists, but the trope that Muslims are anti-Semitic is prevalent in liberal circles that I think liberals have realized it's racist to assume Muslims are terrorists or terrorist supporters, just as a matter of course, Mr. Aziz said. But I don't think that's the case when it comes to anti-Semitism. Top Democrats have stopped short of calling Mr. Mamdani an anti-Semite. But when Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York castigated him, they used a phrase like, "He left open far too much space for extremists." Governor Shapiro said that he made reference to global jihad, Senator Gillibrand, for which she later apologized. With just over 2 weeks until Election Day, some top Democrats, including the Senate Minority Leader, Mr. Schumer, and the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, who also represent New York, have not endorsed him, despite the fact that he may well become the next Democratic mayor of the city. Jay Jacobs, the chairman of the New York State Department Party, said he would resign before he would back Mr. Mamdani. All cited Mr. Mamdani's criticism of Israel is a major reason for withholding support. They continue to hold out despite support from Mr. Mamdani from a number of prominent Democrats, such as Kathy Hochul and Representatives Pamela Giappel, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Jamie Raskin, as well as Senator Bernie Sanders. On the campaign trail, Mr. Mamdani's opponents, Eric Adams, who dropped out of the race last month, and Andrew Cuomo, repeatedly suggested Mr. Mamdani is anti-Semitic. One of the candidates running for mayor is spewing anti-Semitism, Mr. Adams reported, told a closed-door meeting of Jewish leaders in March. "We know all too well the words matter," Mr. Cuomo said of Mr. Mamdani's globalization, the Infatada episode. "They fuel hate. They fuel murder." I asked Mr. Mamdani what he made of accusations of anti-Semitism when they came from members of his party. "Nothing that has happened in the general election has been as hateful as what happened in the primary election," he responded. "It was within a Democratic primary, and so much of our party's politics is ostensibly in opposition to the public, the vision of the country, and yet what we saw is quite a bit of room for Islamophobia within our own party." Mr. Mamdani said he committed to approaching his detractors from a place of understanding. You have to distinguish between that which he said in good faith and that which he said in bad faith. For those who express fear in good faith, and he said he extends good faith to those unless you know otherwise, he approached them with the aim of understanding the basis of the fear. Some of the fear is connected to things that I have proposed. Some of it is connected with things that are imagined around what I have said or proposed. I don't begrudge the New Yorkers who have concerns about me, Mr. Mamdani said, because for many of them, they have only engaged with the caricature of me. Correcting that caricature has become one of the key agenda items for the campaign. After his primary victory, Mr. Mamdani had a number of closed form meetings with members of the Jewish community, particularly groups and congregations that were troubled by his globalized De Infatada response. Among the skeptics is Haley Sofer, the chief executive of the Jewish Democratic Council. She explained to me why the fear of a Mamdani mayoralty should be treated as valid, citing a recent spate of attacks on Jews, the killing of two Israel embassy workers in Washington, the firebombing of a group marching in Colorado in support of Israel hostages, and the arson attack at the governor's mansion in Pennsylvania, which targeted Mr. Shapiro and his family, as a key reason the Jewish community is on high alert. I asked her what she believed would happen to Jews in New York if Mr. Mamdani took over City Hall. She said Jewish New Yorkers were concerned that the elected head of the city that has the largest Jewish population outside of Israel is going to potentially give a green light to those who want to inflict harm on Jewish Americans. I don't think there's a belief among Jews that he himself would be a perpetrator of violence, she said. But there's a concern that his language is giving a permissive structure to those who may. Ms. Sofer listed the several issues that she said must be clarified against the Jewish community's trust. His past support of an economic boycott of Israel, his refusal to say Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state rather than as a state with equal rights for all, and his definition of what constitutes an anti-Semitic hate crime. We have this rise in anti-Zionist beliefs manifesting themselves in anti-Semitic violence, Ms. Sofer said. People are concerned about their safety, she went on. They're concerned about security. And they want to know that whomever they elect as mayor shares this concern. Incidents of anti-Semitism have undoubtedly increased over the past 2 years. The FBI recorded more than 4,000 incidents of anti-Jewish hate crimes since 2023, more than half of them destruction or vandalism of property. This month, an assailant rammed his car into a group of Jewish congregants in front of a synagogue in Manchester, England, on Yom Kippur, holiest day of the Jewish calendar. Two of the congregants died. Audrey Sasson, the economic director of Jews for Racial Economic Justice, told me that many Jewish New Yorkers are navigating their political decisions through the rise in anti-Semitism. A lot of liberal Jews are in the middle place, who are afraid of rising anti-Semitism in the age of Trump, but not sure how to feel about a mayoral candidate, she said. It surfaced a moment of real reckoning for the Jewish community. There's a lot of whispering happening, she said. Is he anti-Semitic? But Ms. Sasson, who has campaigned for Mr. Mamdani, said that when many of the Jewish community get a chance to know Mr. Mamdani, the character falls away. We saw how vulnerable he spoke about the impact of that on him emotionally. She went on referring to a moment of the campaign trail in early June, when he choked back tears speaking about accusations of anti-Semitism he's been facing. Cuomo and Adams are here to use Jews as pawns to use are real Jewish fears, he said. There's a tragic dynamic between anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in the years since October 7th. Jews and Muslims are tiny minorities in this country, both on the receiving end of conspiratorial racism and prejudice policies, now at various other points in American history. At the extremes on the right and the left, they are often intertwined. The Trump administration's tactics, which use the accusation of anti-Semitism as a blunt tool to suppress pro-Palestinian speech, and make the questions of whether it's harder to be a Muslim or a Jew in America into a kind of zero-sum contest. As Mr. Mamdani attempts to make inroads with Jewish voters who have brought their experience with anti-Semitism to the fore of his campaign, he's been on the blunt end of racism and bigotry himself. The expected outburst from the right against Mr. Mamdani's socialist policies are paired with racist accusations. They are the openly Islamophobic statements from MAGA stalwarts like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who posted an IR-generated image of the Statue of Liberty wearing a burqa after his primary win, and Laura Loomer, a Trump confidant, who wrote on social media that Mr. Mamdani is literally supported by terrorists. New York City is about to see 9/11 2-0. Another editorial comment. It's interesting where people either on the left or the right, that they're so close-minded. The answer to all of this is in the middle, but it seems the middle has escaped this. But it all goes beyond online statements. Mr. Mamdani has received a string of death threats since he began campaigning. I listened to a voicemail message left in the office. A man with a deep voice said, "You should go back to fucking Uganda before I shoot you in the fucking head." Excuse the language, listeners. I'm just reading what the paper says. "Your whole family, too, you piece of SHIT Muslims, don't belong here. You're not comparable with our Western values." I've read hundreds of Islamophobic slurs written online against Mr. Mamdani for this essay, leaving me pained but somehow unfazed. You get used to it when you lived here your whole life. Having the unbridled hate in someone's voice felt different. In September, a man in Texas was charged with making terrorism threats as a hate crime against Mr. Mamdani. Many politicians, including many of his Democratic peers, have remained noticeably silent as Mr. Mamdani has faced these threats and racist outbursts. "As a Muslim American, I have found the way his party has failed him particularly wrenching. It echoes what so many of us have experienced from the institutions we are part of, big and small, and the repercussions we have faced in the wake of October 7th. No matter how established, or sometimes because of how established we are, we may feel as though we belong in the communities and circles we are part of, but advocacy for Palestinians and advocacy for ourselves can cast us out of them overnight, like the nurse at NYU." This is what made the psyche toll of this particular moment crushing for so many Muslims in America. There have been progress. We do have Muslim politicians, professors, business leaders, cultural icons, but it's matched with the heartbreak of betrayed from the very communities that we believe have embraced us. Many of us grew up with the images, the never-ending image of people who look just like us, covered in ashes and rubble created by American bombs. Then many Muslims felt they could say nothing. Now Israel has extended its bombing campaigns beyond Gaza to Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, Iran, and even Qatar, merely registering horror for even righteous anger at the state responsible for leaving tens of thousands of civilians across these countries dead, still carrying consequences. The arrest and detention of people like Mr. Kali and Ms. Ozturk Send a message just as the firing nurse does, and just as treatment of a mayoral candidate does, having trouble pronouncing M-A-Y-O-R-O. Tells us that Muslim suffering is acceptable and that there's a cost if we dare say otherwise. Mr. Mamdani, with his dimpled smile and affable attitude, is in the same way an unlikely face for the paradox of the current moment facing Muslims. But his boy next door charm might be the reason he's among the first Muslim to break into the American mainstream the way it has. My Muslim friends, I often joke that he's our gold star boy because of his goody two-shoes past. The most dirt the New York Post has been dug up is that he once pilfered a table while in college. When I was sitting in his campaign office, I asked Mr. Mamdani what it was like to be both the face of progress for one community and a harbinger of Islamist evil to another. Feels like a contradiction. Both the promise of the moment and the backlash is the very thing, he replied. Our gold star boy looked a little weary from his day of campaigning. Wearier still when he paused to consider the racist vitriol that comes his way. To be a Muslim in public life, Illinois will face things of this nature. It doesn't mean that they're acceptable, doesn't mean that they are not disgusting, but it also means they are not surprising. I felt a sense of worriness, too, hearing Mr. Mamdani's resign himself to this reality. There's a shared grief among Muslims right now, one that feels redundant about when we express it to one another. Sitting with Muslim friends or family members over the course of these past years, we often speak of the path of witnessing the horrors coming out of Gaza, a pain that is dependent on the hypocrisy and hostility of American institutions. I know, I often myself saying over and over again, I know. The ravages of the war, whole cities wiped off the map, tens of thousands dead, the largest cohort of child amputees in recent history, have had a lasting effect on the Muslim American psyche. Now, even with a ceasefire in effect, it's difficult to imagine how an end to the war in Gaza could put the genie back into the bottle. For many of us, the pain comes in part from upholding a stoic facade, while those who spew venom face a few or no consequences. It's seeing peers casually dehumanize Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians, and knowing that calling is out is largely futile, if not dangerous. It's seeing that kind of language come through institutions as small as a middle school all the way up to the White House. It's not as if nothing has changed. Slightly more than half American adults now have a somewhat or very unfavorable view of Israel, and a clear majority say they are concerned with starvation in Gaza and Israel's strikes that kill Palestinian civilians. Even as many of our institutions have failed us, the American people seem finally to be grasping what we've known all along. But Muslims have been made to grin and bear it in America for more than two decades. Watching Mr. Mamdani stand unwaveringly in the face of a stream of anti-Muslim abuse, it's a witness the distillation of the dynamic of a single person. I'd be lying if I said I think his fate in this particular matter will improve over time. It is certainty that Mr. Mamdani, if he wins the mayoralty, will have to contend with even more Islamophobic slurs on a national scale. In the face of this, it's easy to become cynical, even as his popularity marks a moment of triumph for Muslims. Mr. Mamdani sees it differently. I used to be quite consumed by forever being a minority, of being an Indian in Uganda or a Muslim in India. All of these things in New York City, he said. To me, it's a sentiment this had to express often over the course of the campaign. It says, once well rehearsed and hurtful. I remember my father telling me that to be a minority is also see the truth of the place, to see promise and see the contradictions of it. Mr. Mamdani finds hope in that tension. I was always left with a clear-eyed sense of the world that I was in, he said, and how to ensure that the contradiction of that world didn't leave you to be a sense of bitterness. Editorial comment. It's a very, very sad editorial. We're in the year 2025, but nothing seems to change. I'm a golden oldie, so in my time, in Buffalo, there were different sections. South Buffalo was Irish, who were Catholic. East Side was Polish and German. North Buffalo was Jewish. West Side was Italian. And there wasn't harmony among those groups. Now that subsided, that's okay. Then came the anti-bias against African Americans. That has seemed to subside a bit. And apparently there's always been anti-Semites around. And now we have the Muslims. And again, it's the year 2025. And as people, as a group, we've made progress on some ends, but we've never been able to obtain the victory of treating human beings as I would be treated. Fraidy Cat at the Pentagon, an article written by Maureen Loud. It is a truth generally acknowledged that Peter Hegseth is a muttonhead. But I come not to bury the self-proclaimed secretary, or rather than appraise him. He's going to spur some superlative Pentagon coverage, because nothing gets a bunch of reporters going like being forced out of the building where they work and being told they aren't allowed to do their jobs. The Pentagon has said it will deny credentials to reporters who seek information that has not been approved for release. Hegseth's already cut off access to large swaths of the Pentagon to reporters without escorts. Journalists have walked the Pentagon Hall since its opening in World War II. They could stake out Jimmy Mattis, defense secretary to President Trump's first term, when he picked up his clothes in an in-house dry cleaner and have an off-the-record chat as he walked back to the office. Shirts clung over his shoulders. They might bump into the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at a Pentagon Starbucks and have a conversation that could turn into a story. Pentagon officials like it because they could clock with the reporters that were working on, and the reporters liked it because they could get tips. Mainstream news outsiders have generally been careful, responsible, sometimes even overly deferential about covering our military and handling sensitive information. The crackdown on reporting supposedly would protect such information, even though the secretary himself personifies the model Loose Lips Sink Ships. He was embarrassed by the revelation that the Atlantic editor Jeffrey Goldberg had been mistakenly added to a chat set about classified war plans to signal that Hegseth had shared details of strike against the Houthis in Yemen in a single chat that included his wife and his brother, and that Elon Musk had been invited to a briefing top secret plans in the event of war in China. And Hegseth, the former weekend Fox News anchor, does not like how the media covered him as he ascended, utterly unqualified, and looking like the third lead of a cheesy spring break movie. As the New Yorker's Jane Mayer wrote of the time, a trail of documents indicated that Hegseth was dumped from prior leadership, possessions of financial mismanagement, sexist behavior, and drinking on the job. His tenure as the Pentagon has been marked by chaos as he pushed out several of the black and female leaders and decided fat troops and fat generals. Knowing his in over his Hegseth has grown more paranoid and resentful, qualities we need in the supervisor of a nearly $1 trillion budget supervising troops and weapons all over the world. When I cover stories in Saudi Arabia, officials attach attach reminders to us. But imposing such undemocratic, restrictive protocols at the Pentagon makes it seem as though we're run by tin pot dictators. Trump can seem more open with reporters. Attention in his oxygen, after all, but he continually maligns the media. And there's a creepy invasion of the body snatcher field to the press corps at the White House now that is perchers of legislative media get filled with MAGA ringers, like the two White House reporters from Mike My Pillow Lindell's news network. One of the Pillow reporters, Kara Castanova, was among the handful of media representatives allowed in with Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. Castrovuna's penetrating questions, consisting of gushing over Trump, who stuck out his neck for a Middle East peace deal, and chiding Zelensky for wanting the weapons that Trump had suggested he might give Ukraine. As he said, Castronovia tartly told the Ukraine president, we need our tomahawks too. Trump dodged Vietnam with his bone spurs excuse, and his call to Iraq were the single worst decision ever made. So somewhere under all the mommers and desire to be praised rather than challenged, he knows we need a vibrant Pentagon media corps to ferret out the truth when our leaders are lying to us to probably start wars. America's greatest fiasco happened because there wasn't enough sunlight cast on them, as a JFK told the Times manager editor Turner Cambridge after the Bay of Pigs. Maybe if we had printed more about the operation, you would have saved us from a colossal mistake. After reporters, including us from Fox News and Newsmax, refused to agree to Hexas' 21-page of conditions, the Defense Department official X account trolled them with a puerile mem. Hexas, immature and unconfident, cannot accept that a free press is integral to democracy. As Thomas Jefferson put it, were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers, or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Hopefully the defense secretary, who will take over when Hexeth is undone by the press for his ineptitude and un-American diktats, will understand that. The secret of Trump's success with Netanyahu. The president gave a deeply unpopular Israel leader a political lifetime. Praise of President Trump's diplomacy in brokering a ceasefire in Gaza has mostly focused on how he persuaded Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel to accept the deal. Many assume that Mr. Trump threatened to withdraw U.S. support from Israel or otherwise pressured the Israeli leader into capitulating. But there is a more convincing explanation for Mr. Trump's success. Far from merely menacing Mr. Netanyahu with consequences, the American president's key intervention was the political lifeline to the deeply unpopular Israeli leader. The secret of Mr. Trump's success with Mr. Netanyahu was offering carrots on domestic politics, not sticks on foreign policy. There were, of course, important external factors that led to the groundwork. Both Israel and Hamas had finally concluded that continuing the war was a losing proposition for Hamas. Israel's operations over the past year has been devastating. The group's ability to maneuver and resupply is hobbled. Its cash flow has been severed, and its top leaders have been eliminated. Outside Gaza, Hamas supporters and the axis of resistance have been degraded by Israel strikes across Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iran itself. Hamas found itself isolated in the region and increasingly unpopular in Gaza. For Israel, the war has reached a tipping point. Its operational gains are no longer outweighed by the collapse of Israel's international standing. The erosion of bipartisan American support over civilian casualties in Gaza or the strain in Israel's war-weary military. The new phase of the war that Mr. Netanyahu announced over the summer, in which Israel aimed to hold most of Gaza, strip and once again clear northern Gaza of Hamas, committed the Israel Defense Forces to an unsustainable drain on munitions and manpower. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from Sunday, October 19th, issue of the New York Times opinion section. We read from the New York Times review section every Sunday at 2 p.m. Your reader's been Dick Shanley. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, followed at 4 by a rebroadcast of this morning's Buffalo News. Please stay for these readings and more throughout the day, and feel free to contact us with your comments, suggestions, with any questions you may have. Looking for a fun and lively way to support your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service? Join us on Friday, November 7th, for our second annual meat raffle at the Main Transit Fire Hall in Williamsville. Doors will open at 6 p.m. The first bin will be at 7 p.m. And tickets are only $10 pre-sale and for veterans. $15 at the door or a discounted $100 for a table of 12. Your admission includes two beers, refillable soft drinks, an American flag to wave on Veterans Day, and the chance to win from a huge selection of prime meat cuts and dozens of raffle prizes. Need tickets, a list of prizes, or more information? Visit your radio reading website at www.nfradioreading.org or call us at 716-821-5555. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have